Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jasmine Darznik, who's the author of a memoir titled The Good Daughter, a memoir of my mother's hidden life. The Good Daughter is about growing up in Iran and eventually coming to America. It's the story of Jasmine Darznik's mother, as told to her through tapes she received, cassettes, and then augmented, I would guess, by asking questions of her mother. Jasmine Darznik is a professor of English and creative writing at Washington and Lee University and has taught Iranian literature. Jasmine Darznik, you began writing portions of this memoir and getting them published around 2007. The photograph of your mother as a girl with a strange man that she'd never mentioned before came right after he died. When exactly did your mother send you those tapes? When did your dad die?
My father died 11 years ago, so I began to write some years after the discovery of the photograph. My father had just passed away, and my mother was absolutely devastated, too, after my father's death. So it wasn't an opportune moment to ask her anything, much of anything, much less about this picture. At that time, my mother and I had a pretty broken relationship, too. We spoke very infrequently. I was living on the East Coast going to graduate school. So it wasn't as if the avenues of communication were all that open in any case. I called her from New Jersey. I first broached the subject on the telephone with her, and she refused to say anything. She shut down completely. She accused me of having stolen this photograph from her, told me outright that this had nothing to do with me. And it was only some weeks later, about 2 months or so after that conversation, that I received the first of what would be 10 tapes.
Now, when the tape arrived, did it arrive with any kind of note from your mother? And did she use the tape recorder before anything?
She actually was in the habit of making cassette tapes for her family back in Iran. Many of her female relatives were illiterate. They were not able to correspond by letter. And it was also very expensive to call each other from Iran for many years during the Iran-Iraq War. So they had a custom of making cassette tapes for one another. She'd never made a cassette tape for me, and she sent that first tape without any preface or preamble at all.
And how did it begin? Did it go, "Hi, Jasmine, this is my story"? I mean, when you turned it on, did you know what you were getting? Did you know anything?
She actually started out by saying that she wasn't sure if it was the right thing to tell me this story. She started with a very long series of, "I'm not sure," and "Will you understand?" and "Nobody knows this. Perhaps it's best I don't tell you." Then she went back. She said, "I can only tell you my story. The only way you'll understand this is to understand your grandmother's story first." So the very first tape, after she made a series of apologies and prefatory remarks, would be the story of my grandmother's marriage.
And that led into her own story. So in a way, she was kind of writing this book, this oral history for you. But you, of course, had to turn it into almost a novelistic version of it down the road. In the book, everybody has names. Now, are all the names changed or only the name of your mother and a few other people?
The only names I have kept as they are my own name and my grandmother's name. My grandmother's name was Cobra, and I so love that name that I wanted to preserve it, but the rest of the names have all been changed.
And what was the purpose of that in terms of the people who had died?
I found when I was writing the story and calling my mother by her real name, I couldn't really inhabit her stance. I couldn't really give a reader her sensibilities. It was only when I gave her a pseudonym, Lily, that I could imagine her as a character and, paradoxically, bring her more fully to life.
These tapes started arriving, and they kept arriving. As they arrived, was it in the back of your mind to do anything with them at that point?
Not at all. I was at that time actually writing my dissertation. I didn't have any particular ambitions to write either fiction or creative nonfiction.
Really? What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on Iranian diasporic literature. I happened to be writing on memoirs and fiction by Iranian immigrants, but I didn't really conceive of myself as a writer at that point.
You hadn't done much writing before or what?
Just bits and pieces. I would never have claimed the mantle of writer at that point.
You get all these tapes, and at what point, under what circumstances, did you finally kind of think, well, maybe there's a memoir here. Maybe there's something.
It was my mother who came to me and suggested that we turn the story of her life into a book. She'd been appraising me both as a daughter and a writer for some time. I'd begun to write shorter pieces, essays for the San Francisco Chronicle and LA Times and so forth. And it was she who came to me and said, let's try our hand at a book.
Well, how did these essays come about if you said you weren't a writer?
I know. Even now I've published a book and it's still a hard mantle to claim. I started taking a workshop at Book Passage in Corte Madera. I was flailing. I was making very little headway on my dissertation and started to take a creative writing workshop. And this really energized me. It gave me reason to finish the dissertation. And I started to publish these shorter pieces. And my writing instructor of the time said, this is a book. And I sort of looked around and I said, who are you talking to? But she said, no, this is a book.
By the time you began publishing segments, I think the earliest one is 2007. Was the book already in mind at that point? I mean, the essays are not quite the same as the book.
No, and many of them actually don't make their way into the book. I began writing the book in about 2006. Some of these essays I published and would make part of the book. Others of them I did not incorporate in the final book.
Well, Jasmine Darznik, let's talk about the book, about your work on the book, more specifically the story, because to me the best kind of memoir or fiction is personal, in which at some point it becomes universal.
Well, this is a great paradox, is how can one tell a story that's intimate and private and yet tell a story that's about other places and other times? It's a bit of a paradox. I think it's the poet Rumi who says, the more particular you get, the more universal you become, and that's my hope.
The Good Daughter deals with your grandmother's life and then your mother's life and then toward the end a little bit about your life. And, of course, a lot of the events and the people are part of the discoveries that you made in listening to the memoir and afterward when you came back to California interviewing your mother, I guess, on a regular basis and taking
That's
notes.
Right. We spent about a year, actually, where I'd show up at her house and she'd make us some tea and I'd come with my notebook and a pen and get to work on the story of her life. We spent many hours together fleshing out the details. The tapes were only just the beginning. They gave me the broad outlines of the story, but filling in the details would be the work of several months.
Let's go back to what you knew before the tapes arose. I mean, you obviously didn't know about the existence of this Kazem, her first husband. What did you know about your mother's life prior to being in Germany and meeting your father? Did you know anything?
Very little. My mother had a quite exalted version of her life story she liked to tell. She loved to tell me about Iran in the 60s and 70s. This was a period of time when Iran was rapidly modernizing itself. But she didn't speak very much at all about her childhood. She certainly had never told me about her marriage, and she never told me about the daughter she had had.
There must have been hints. Your grandmother, Cobra, lived with you. There must have been hints all along that the girl you call Sarah actually existed.
I didn't know. Now I put it together and I can think back on whispered conversations. I can think about phone calls late at night. But at that time as a child, I really had no conception, apart from one illusion, and that would be when my mother would tell me about this good daughter back in Iran. She used to tell me, if you don't behave, if you're not a good girl, I'll go back to Iran to my good daughter.
And you thought that was a fiction.
Well, when I was really little, I believed her, and I was terrified. I thought that this good daughter would steal my mother away from me. But as I became a teenager, I thought, oh, this is just one of my mother's crazy Iranian methods of trying to keep me in line.
Now, what about your dad? Didn't he give any hints of this either?
Not at all. He actually had not told his own family this. There was a lot of secrecy within even my mother's extended family. No one ever talked of this to me within the extended family, and my father never spoke of it either. When my mother divorced, when she was just 14 years old, it was with the promise that she never speak of this daughter. And honestly, this promise held fast, even in America, even 50 years later. She didn't tell her best friends in America that she had been married. She did not tell them that she had another child. If she spoke of it with my grandmother, it would have been just between the two of them. She never told me outright any parts of her story.
You didn't have any contact with any of the other relatives?
No, and it seems to me that if we had stayed in Iran, it would have been impossible for my mother to keep this secret. But once we came to America, that made possible the hiding of this whole life story.
Did your mother give you any good reason why she wanted the story told and why she told it to you and why she wanted it told to the world? Because I'm sure she's proud of the book now.
I feel like this was her chance to tell her story for the first time. The weight of that secret must have been tremendous for my mother, a secret 50 years she kept to herself. My sister was brought up really to think my mother had abandoned her on purpose. She was actually told my mother was chara, broken, damaged, or a bad woman, a prostitute. And it's only actually at this 11th hour become clear to me that in some ways this book is my mother's opportunity to tell her story to my sister through me, to explain the circumstances that led to the divorce and to the surrender of that daughter.
And what does she think of the book now?
She has very mixed feelings. There are moments even now where she says, stop the presses, if you can imagine, and I tell her it's too far gone. For that, she's kind of in the literary version of the Witness Protection Program. She's living with me now in Virginia. When I moved out there, she came. And she's, I think, much more comfortable being in a place where she's not going to run into her friends and be accosted and suffer all of their gossip and their questions. It's much easier for her to be on the East Coast right now than in California.
One thing about your book, The Good Daughter, Jasmine Darznik, is that there have been so few memoirs about that particular time in Iran, which is the period of the Shah and his father, rather than what's happened since.
Yes. And I wasn't so interested, though, of course, it's a very rich and important time, Iran, in the revolutionary period. But what so engrossed me were these lives in the 20s and 30s and 40s, a time when women were being remade and remade and remade by, as you say, not only the last Shah, but his father, Reza Shah. In 1936, the veil, for instance, had been outlawed. And my mother's family were among those families who refused to go out into the streets at all, because for them, such a pious Muslim family, it was as shocking as going out into the streets naked. So that's a part of Iran's history that I think is less known to Americans.
Well, when you look back now at your view of what's happened since the revolution, what insights do you think you've gained from having researched The Good Daughter about how it came about and the way in which the mullahs have transformed Iran back to a civilization that hadn't existed for decades?
I think that when I look back now at Iran's history, I understand that Iran for many decades has been caught between tradition and modernity. This would come to play very dramatically in my mother's life. She came from a very pious family. Her marriage was hastened at the age of 13. But it was those kinds of really oppressive experiences that made her into the woman she was. So having written the book and researched the book, I have a far greater appreciation for the toughness of Iran's women. I have a far greater appreciation for also how women themselves have been complicit in these histories. It was the women of my mother's family who married my mother, really. It was not her father. It was the women of her family. So it's a far more complicated story than we usually hear of.
What it opened to me was an entire world that I knew nothing about. And as we go through this list of some of the things that occurred in terms of women, maybe you can give us an update on their relationship to Iran today from what you know. For instance, the idea of multiple marriages. I mean, is that back in vogue in Iran now?
I have not lived in Iran, so it's hard for me to speak to the experience of Iran's women right now. I know that divorce is far more common now. I have heard, though, that, let's say, the preoccupations with purity and chastity are very much still alive in Iran. And so I do think there are certain themes that still bear out in contemporary Iran.
The idea of doctors cleaning up virginity, for example.
Yes, and this is practiced in Iran still. My mother, when she would become a midwife and have her own clinic, actually would assist in procedures of this kind. And for her, it was a mercy to send these girls out with stamps of purity, because otherwise their families would have, I'm not sure what they would have done, but they would have lashed out terribly at these girls. So my mother, in her own right, was a real strident feminist.
The idea that somebody is forced into a marriage at 13 to an abusive older husband, not that he was an old man, but he was an adult, it's so awful that she needs to get a divorce, and yet she's the one who's being ostracized. That's bizarre.
Well, it recalls to me the story of women in America in the 50s who'd be sent away. Often young teenage mothers would be sent away and would give birth to their children, and they would very much suffer the same kind of fate. They'd be told, you can't tell anybody, and there would be a lot of shame. I think it's not so far from stories we've heard in America about young girls who become pregnant and give up their children. In Iranian culture, there's a lot of secrecy surrounding domestic abuse, alcoholism, mental illness. All of these would unfortunately figure in my mother's life. And as you say, she would suffer not just the abuses, but also the censure of her peers and even her family.
And the only girls who really got good schooling were the ones who either never married. I mean, if you married, you were suddenly encased in this world that you could barely leave, even with a veil.
Well, my grandfather understood that the only way she could continue her education once she was divorced was to pretend as if she were still a virgin, a girl, unmarried. So she grew her pigtails out long, for instance, and she was told, you cannot tell anyone you were married. If anyone at her school knew, she would have been sent out.
What kind of fun did she have as a kid? I mean, there wasn't radio. There wasn't television. I mean, she read a lot of poetry. Was the culture of Iran just generally among all people, or just the educated, more educated classes, that kind of emphasis on culture and poetry?
Poetry would have figured possibly in families of a higher social strata than my family's. They were great storytellers in my mother's family. So that would have been part of her childhood. She recounts pilgrimages, let's say, maybe we wouldn't think of as fun, but pilgrimages to holy shrines would have been like a holiday for my mother as a child. To take a train and visit a shrine was a tremendous treat, for example. Visits to the bazaar were a treat. It would seem a marvel to her to enter the great bazaar in Tehran. So there were certainly preoccupations and pleasures when she was a child, but those would quickly recede as she became a married woman.
And then suddenly she's stuck in a very poor part of town with a baby and a husband who is either absent or beats her.
That's right. And my mother didn't know until she was married that her husband suffered from some kind of mental illness. She had only seen him a few times before the marriage, maybe a half dozen or a dozen times, or I think actually a half dozen times, and they were never allowed to spend much time together. It was only when they married that she really took measure of his illness.
Today, the family that you're in touch with back there, do they ever talk politics? And if they do, what are those politics?
I don't have any cousins still left in Iran. The closest person to me was my grandmother, and she died 5 or 6 years ago. So that's not a conversation I have with my family anymore. None of them are left.
Well, your sister is, but you've not had contact with her, correct?
I have not. She and my mother have been in touch over the years. It's a very fraught and pained relationship, as you may imagine. When my mother left Iran, my sister was left behind. Like many Iranian families, my family would be torn apart by the revolution. And it's been like the phrase in Persian is, it's a broken vessel. You can try to patch it up, but it will always be broken. So they've been in touch, but there's a lot of anger and resentment on my sister's side and a lot of trauma on my mom's.
Let's go back to those tapes and how you convert that into a story that reads more like a novel than like nonfiction. First of all, had you ever considered calling it a novel?
I did think about it, not so much because I wanted to have more rein or give myself more liberty, but because there have been a number of memoirs published in the last 10 years, a whole spate of them, actually. And when my agent first started pitching the book, she was met with several no's. It was said to her, oh, Iran's been done. The Iranian memoir has been done. And I kind of took offense to this, and I said, well, fine, I'll do it as a novel. But in the end, it felt very important to tell this story as a memoir. I think there's an authority in a true story, and the darker aspects of the story are much less easy to dismiss in a memoir than they would have been in a novel. Also, my mom's story is so extraordinary. If I had written this as a novel, you would have told me this is implausible. The sequence of events that led to her divorce are so uncanny, I could not have possibly made them up and made them credible to a reader.
Jasmine Darznik, you've got these tapes and you're starting to put it together, and you have to create detail, but you can't go to Iran. How do you do that?
My life here in America was very much an Iranian life. Immigration made my mother more Iranian, not less so. Rituals like the wedding rites and the funeral rites were very familiar to me growing up here in the Iranian-American community. So I was familiar with many of these details. The rest of it, I labored over. I researched. I consulted a 6-volume encyclopedia in Persian on old Iran. Fortunately, I'm the kind of writer that relishes that kind of work. And my mother would tell me, for example, the story of how my grandmother would go to the Jewish baths in Tehran, and I'd run back to the encyclopedia and we'd together read the entry on the Jewish baths. So any given page is pulling from a number of sources: my mother's memories, my own impressions and memories, secondary sources such as this encyclopedia. I read cookbooks. I listened to Persian music. I created an Iranian world for myself as I was writing this book.
Did you go to a map and try to figure out where your mother lived, the relationship of the places in Tehran?
I did have a general understanding of the old Tehran. I knew, for example, the bottom of the city would have been the wrong side of the tracks. That's where she lived as a young bride. But Iran has changed so much. Many of these streets no longer exist. The Shah in the 60s and 70s would radically alter the contours and the shape of the city of Tehran. So much of this Iran no longer exists at all.
Your grandfather took your mother on several trips out of the city. Mm-hmm. And was that pretty much just based on her memory then?
Yes, that was. And that was actually a common practice. Many Tehrani families would go to the foothills of the Alborz Mountains. It was a source of much pleasure in the springtime, say, to go to the foothills and have picnics there. And it was there that she would spend longer periods of time with her father. He wasn't so much a part of her life when she was a child, so it was a great pleasure for her to go and visit him.
Now, what about your uncle? What's his story?
He went to Germany at the time of the revolution, and he had studied in Germany as well. My mother was only actually sent to Germany because he had been sent before, and his children were educated there, and he's still there in Germany.
Did you have any contact with him in the writing of this book?
No, I did not.
Do you have any contact with him at all?
I do. I'm actually quite close to him. But the story I wanted to tell was really my mother's. So I didn't interview him, for instance, because I felt his sensibilities are more Iranian. He wouldn't so much have liked my writing about him a lot. So I only really talk about him when it's really relevant to my mother's story. Everyone in my mother's family swore secrecy when my mother divorced. And the only way he would have talked to me is if my mother had first gone to him and said, "You have my permission, you have my blessing to speak to Jasmine."
Your grandmother ran a beauty shop called the Lady Diola Beauty Shop. As a little girl, you were there, and there's a hint that this woman that you knew, this girl there, was actually your sister. Is that correct?
That's right. So from time to time, this girl, who I thought quite beautiful with long flowing hair, would come and play with me. And I didn't know when she'd come or why she came, who she belonged to, but she was my sister. No one told me at the time that she was my sister. And I was so young when I left Iran that I would completely forget that she had been there until later my mother would tell me the story and I would begin to remember very faintly, very, very faintly, these encounters I had with her at the Lady Diola.
When the revolution happened and your grandmother was still at the beauty shop, things changed, but on some level they may not have. At home in the compounds, which seems to be a way of life in Iran, the women just take off their chadors and their westernized clothing goes right back on. Is that correct?
Well, that would have been the case for my grandmother. And my grandmother, the line I use in the book is that women's vanities would survive every calamity.
Right.
She knew that her hair salon would survive the revolution. She knew the hair salon would survive the Iran-Iraq war. I do believe this is true, that many women, though they in public cannot appear modern or westernized, if anything, they're more fashionable than women in America. Often you hear people who go back to Iran, Iranian Americans who go back, and they're kind of looked at as country bumpkins. You know, if you don't wear makeup, you're often asked, why don't you? Or why don't you color your hair? The aesthetic is very much a Western one there.
Jasmine Darznik, two areas that are kind of glossed over a little bit. Mm-hmm. One completely glossed over is what it was like in Iran during World War II. Mm-hmm. You kind of go directly from the 30s into mm-hmm. the late 40s. The other is what it was like to live in Tehran during the period of the Iraq-Iran War.
Mm-hmm. I actually do tell a bit about that period in the early 40s. My mother started out telling me how my grandmother used to hunt birds in the courtyard, and that would have been during the Second World War. And I thought, what a strange habit. Why did she do this? And it was the scarcity of food. It was because there was rationing in Iran. And my grandmother, in her endless ingenuity, would hunt birds in the courtyard and prepare them as food. And as for the period of the Iran-Iraq War, my grandmother lived through that time. We would receive missives or telephone calls from her. And it was very difficult, especially for a woman alone in Tehran during those years. Unfortunately, my grandmother died before I began to write this book, so I couldn't talk to her about that period of her life. But I do know that it was a very difficult period for her.
And I noticed that the name Khanum mm-hmm. is both madam, mm-hmm. so everyone's a Khanum, but also the name you gave to your great-grandmother.
It's interesting. No one would have ever called her by her name. It would have been disrespectful. Khanum was a term of respect. So it was she who became known as the Mrs., the Madam.
The other element I noticed is, and you refer to it before, is the way all of the women in these families were complicit in ensuring a very hard life for women.
I never imagined that they thought they were being cruel. I really do believe that my mother's grandmother and her aunts, in their own way, were trying to do the best for her. They were very scared that she was going out into the streets without a veil. They were very frightened what would happen to our daughter. And to their minds, marriage was a refuge for her. Unfortunately, they didn't make the proper inquiries. They didn't really ask the questions that might have prevented that marriage. If they had known, for example, that the suitor was mentally ill, they wouldn't have given her away. But part of the reason that happened is that my mother's mother and her father had such a tempestuous and terrible marriage that the women of the family thought, let's get her away from the troubles of her parents. Let's put her into a new home where possibly she'll have some peace.
And, of course, she wanted to go to school, and that was the end of that.
And there was actually a promise when they were negotiating about the marriage. My grandfather was very keen that she should continue her education, but my mother almost immediately became pregnant, and there was no going back to school once she became pregnant.
Did your mother ever think that she could pursue her medical career here, or was that just simply a pipe dream because she was working at the motel?
Well, my mother was actually a nurse midwife, so she wasn't a doctor, a medical doctor. She would tell me, they used to call me Khanum Doktor or Madam Doctor in Iran, but she was a nurse. And she was nearly 40 years old when we came to America. There really was no time to stop and acquire American degrees and certificates. My parents did what many immigrants do, which is to start up a small business just to survive. There was no time to acquire an American nursing degree.
These compounds, these places where people live, I still don't get quite a sense. I mean, are you going down the street and seeing just walled compounds one after another if you're going down the street?
Well, right now, Tehran is very much a modern city. People live in apartment buildings. It's a very congested city. So they don't live in family compounds. Iranian family life has changed quite a lot since my mother's day. That way of life where you had many families living together under one roof doesn't really exist, perhaps more so in the provinces, but not so much in Tehran.
There are a lot of parties, a lot of people, a lot of gatherings, and I guess that has not changed because that's part of Iranian culture.
Iranians are great, in a sense, pleasure seekers, I'd say. They love to gather. There are many rituals of food and kinship and so many beautiful customs and traditions that I actually, thankfully, I did grow up with, even in the States here. Again, accounts that my friends tell me, people are very much have a double life in Iran. They have the life on the street, which is the one that we see on the television. And then at home, they have very much a full life with parties and birthdays and dinner parties, everything.
From your understanding of what's been happening recently in places like Egypt, Bahrain, and Libya, and I know there's been some movements in Iran which have been shut down, do you think that the mullahs are a house of cards and that someday, like the Soviet Union, they'll just vanish? Or what do you see?
Iran's population is very young. They are increasingly linked to the rest of the world. I think we saw in 2009 after the elections how very in touch they are. They're using Facebook. They're on Twitter. So it's a young population. It's a population that, as we saw again in 2009, is hankering for more rights, is hankering for more human rights. And I do think that the change will come. But for 30 years, Iranians here in America have been watching and wondering when.
You also have an interesting comment in one of your essays that there's this kind of secret royalist sympathy within your family.
It was meant as a cheeky line. It wasn't meant as a political commentary, but I was talking about how my mom used to dress me up like some Iranian royal. She had this conception of what a high-class girl looked like, and she had that impression from how the Iranian royal family reconstructed themselves in the model or mold of the European aristocracy. So she used to send me to school in two-piece skirt suits, for example.
There's a lot about food in the book. I guess your mom's a good cook.
Well, she tells me now I'm a far better cook, and I learned to cook actually by a cookbook, which is how none of the women of my family learned to cook. She loved to cook when I was growing up. My grandmother was a fantastic cook as well. And part of what I wanted to do with this book is not only tell what's often a painful story, but also render a lot of the beauty and the marvelous details of Iranian culture. One of those aspects is the food and the rituals of food.
Well, when you were living here, were there any restaurants you went to which were particularly, maybe they're still around, maybe not, particularly good Persian restaurants?
Iranians never go out for stew. Those would be dishes that you would eat at home. That's what your mother or your grandmother would make. If we ever went to a Persian restaurant, it would be for kebab. That was the only kind of food you went. No real Iranian, no self-respecting Iranian would go out and have stew at a Persian restaurant. That was for Americans. If you went out to a Persian restaurant, you were eating kebab.
And the motel that you grew up in, is that still around?
It still stands. So when my parents came in the late 70s, they purchased a motel off the Highway 101. And my mother pretty much single-handedly ran that motel. It still stands. It's no longer the Casa Buena. It's been bought by one of these larger chains and cleaned up quite a lot. It's next to the restaurant called Marin Joe's in Corte Madera.
Okay.
And as I say, it's been converted, so it looks a lot better than it did in the days my parents ran it.
So you can see it on 101 when you're heading, you're right next to it when you're heading south toward the city.
I saw it this morning on my way here.
How do you feel going back to Book Passage, knowing that's where you got your start?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. Book Passage made this book possible. I've had so many wonderful mentors. And, of course, when I was growing up, I used to hole up there between the stacks, and I'd go and listen to Isabel Allende and Anne Lamott. And what an amazing resource for writers in our community.
In terms of memoirs coming out of Iran, if someone wants to read more, what books would you recommend specifically?
A book that I've always loved is Cry of the Peacock by Gina Nahai, and that's based actually on oral history, so it does skim that line between fact and fiction. And that's the story of generations of an Iranian Jewish family in Tehran. Beautiful book. I'd recommend also Shahrnush Parsipur's Women Without Men, which is a book that actually landed her in prison and led to her exile here in the States. And I'd recommend also some poetry from Iran, a wonderful iconic poet that we have, Furugh Farrokhzad. There is a new translation of her work by a poet named Shola Wolpe. The collection is called Sin. And I'd recommend also Persis Karim's Let Me Tell You Where I've Been. That's an anthology of Iranian-American writing that's excellent.
And films?
I have a lot of respect for Shireen Nashat, who started out as a visual artist and has recently adapted Parsipur's novel Women Without Men into a film. That's a superlative film. I'd recommend it very highly.
For you, do you expect at some point then to go back when things have changed? Have you thought about going back before?
I do. I've thought about it all the time. I've thought about it for many years. And unfortunately, the situation has become more precarious in the last couple of years in particular. I think when you're an immigrant, part of you always imagines you'll return, if only for a time. And it feels to me the kind of trip I have to make in my lifetime. So I will do it. I hope to do it. I don't know when I can.
Jasmine Darsnik, do you now have the writing bug?
I do. I'm working on a novel now, actually.
Set in
1950s Tehran.
Based upon a lot of the materials that you've used here.
Yes, that's right. But this time I am giving myself license over a story that is a wonderful liberty I'm extending to myself in imagining a story fully.
Jasmine Darsnik, it seems pretty clear that writing the book has transformed your relationship with your mother. She's living with you now. You guys finally get along?
Well, we're mother and daughter, and we'll forever wrangle. daily, we wrangle. But it's been an extraordinary gift to sit down with her and learn the story of her life. She's entrusted me with a really extraordinary story that she herself could never have told, that I've never read anywhere. So I'm deeply grateful, not just for the experience of having written the book, but for the closeness that's come up between us.
Do you sometimes run out of your room now with your computer and say, hey, Mom, what was it like doing such and such and such and such? I got this in the novel and I'm not sure.
No, actually, I am taking a break from from working with her. It was hard to work. I think it's just always hard to work with relatives, mother and daughter maybe especially. So that was a quite a taxing year that we spent together, and not one that I'm likely to repeat anytime soon.
But I guess you'll get her to vet the novel because she knows Tehran from the 50s.
Yeah, and the story I'm writing has certain resemblances to this story. The woman in it divorces, and she, like my mother, becomes the object of ostracism.
You've been listening to an interview with Jasmine Darsnik, whose book is titled The Good Daughter, A Memoir of My Mother's Hidden Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.